No talking points, no spin, it's politics you can't put down. This is Still Standing with Michael Caputo.
It's Michael Caputo again. Thanks a lot for listening in. You can catch my podcast at stillstandingpodcast.com, and also you can catch some video as well as some blog in there, stillstandingpodcast.com. I've got a bit of a cold today, which is a drag because I'm in Puerto Rico working, not hanging out with Democrats, not sitting on the beach working. But somehow or another, the head cold crept in while I was here. I leave tonight, headed back home. But yeah, so you'll hear a little difference in my voice today. And if I suddenly start coughing, you know where it's coming from. I know you probably got it too. I've heard this is going around. I finally got it last night here. It's Thursday morning. It took a couple of days to sneak up on me. I'm sure I got it on the plane on the way down. But I'll tell you, I'm down here actually scouting a documentary that I'll be working on. This place is still messed up 18 months after Hurricane Maria. I'm actually shocked at how things are moving along down here. Not about, at the damage. You know, I've been working in hurricane relief for a long time, for almost 10 years, certainly since Katrina. And, you know, hurricanes are just deadly, lethal, and incredibly damaging. I've lived through three or four of them myself when I was in Miami. And the damage, you know, depending upon how strong the hurricane is, it's pretty similar. It doesn't really matter if the hurricane is in Miami Beach or in Puerto Rico or in Houston. You know, it's devastating. But what I always look at is the aftermath and how things move along, how recovery goes, and how victims are treated. And Puerto Rico, I'll tell you what, it is still probably, it's got to be the worst I've ever seen. Not the damage, like I said, but the way that people are being treated afterward. We heard about the recovery and how it was stunted and how FEMA was failing. I don't really look at how FEMA handles things too closely directly after a storm, because believe me, these storms are devastating, and trying to pick it up, trying to help people afterward is a huge problem. It's very difficult to do. FEMA usually does a pretty good job at that stuff. They're highly criticized, especially when a hurricane hits an island like Puerto Rico, where, you know, services and such are, you know, have to be flown in. It's not like in Florida or Houston where you could see lines of hundreds of electrical workers, you know, just like, you know, lines of trucks, power trucks coming down the highway immediately after the storm ends. Everything's got to move in. You know, Puerto Rico had to be a really difficult situation. But, you know, my God, 18 months on, people are just getting ripped off. I mean, ripped off. Not just the victims in their homes, but their homeowners insurance. I mean, I think FEMA is probably doing a pretty decent job at this point. FEMA is not really the culprit this time around. I've seen FEMA do really terrible things to victims in the past, especially in Hurricane Sandy. You know, FEMA was the culprit. FEMA was really guilty of ripping off just, you know, average Americans. Here in Puerto Rico, the average American family, you know, there are thousands upon thousands who aren't really turning to FEMA because, you know, FEMA tends to help people with flood damage. And even though there was a lot of flooding in Puerto Rico, it's really a kind of a wind event. And, you know, what people are finding when filing their homeowners claims with their insurance company is the insurance company is actually paying like 8 or 10 cents on a dollar, which in this situation here in Puerto Rico, that is a horrible situation. But it gets even worse than that. The municipalities down here, there are 78 mayors, 78 towns and cities down here in Puerto Rico. These, almost every one of these municipalities has multi-million dollar insurance claims, but some, you know, 50 and 60 million, some of them, they have buildings that are wiped out, you know, community centers that are wiped out, activity and recreation centers that are wiped out, very important and vital linchpin services in these towns are still leveled. 18 months later, they're leveled. I'm leaving today from the hotel to go to an area a couple of hours away on the way to Rincon. And I've been told to expect this area to look almost like the storm happened, you know, not 18 months ago, but a couple of weeks ago. Some of the stories here are really heartbreaking, but what really bothers me is that the insurance companies here, the towns, these municipalities, these 78 municipalities, and even government agencies like, you know, water plants and essential services, they're not getting paid. I mean, the insurance companies take the money for their premiums for years and years and years. And Puerto Rico didn't have a really radical hurricane storm event for a long time. Taking these premiums for years and years and years. And there's a town down here that I visited the other day that has a $60 million claim that was totally wiped out. And they got an offer from their insurance company for something like, I think it was like $450,000. $450,000 on a $60 million claim. And, you know, this is a claim that was put together by expert public adjusters, you know, not, you know, looking to rip off the insurance company. Sure, there's negotiation between what the public adjuster says and what the insurance company is willing to pay. But my God, to have less than, it was about 8 cents on a dollar. That's nuts. And of course, a lot of the people who left the island and aren't coming back are the folks who are still earners, so the police and firefighters who, you know, decided that they didn't want to stick around and left, and middle class, you know, doctors and others left and they're not coming back. The people that are, they remain here in a lot of ways are the underclass and the elderly, and they need the services that these towns are providing. And these, I mean, of course, these insurance companies, a lot of them aren't, you know, State Farm and Allstate, the insurance companies that we know. These are foreign insurance companies that are down here from Spain, from the UK, who are insuring the people and the municipalities and the businesses of Puerto Rico. But what's really interesting to me is that the mayors and the agency, government agency heads, and the, you know, the presidents of condo boards, condos that are wiped out, they don't want to settle. I'm sorry, they don't want to sue. You know, they don't want to go after the money that's due to them, which is dramatic to me, because they don't understand that if they don't go after every penny that's owed to them by their insurance company, they think they're just going to get it from FEMA. Now, September is the deadline for people to try to get their insurance money. After that, you know, you may be in litigation, you may be in negotiations, but if you haven't sued by September, you're not going to be able to sue, right? I guess that's kind of, you know, the deadline, two-year from the time of the storm, from the date of the storm, which was September 20th, 2 years ago. So these people down here believe that if they don't get the money they're supposed to get from their insurance company, that FEMA's just going to pay. And that's not how FEMA does it. If you don't try your hardest, including sue, to get the money that you deserve, FEMA's not going to write you a check. They're not going to, like, say, let's say Rincon, the town down the coast that I'm going to today. Let's say Rincon is owed like $50 million, right? And they're only given $600,000. I'm making that up. I don't know where Rincon's at on this stuff. Rincon goes and tries to get the rest of the money from FEMA. They're not going to get it. FEMA's going to say, you didn't try and get it from your insurance company. We're writing it off. And the elderly and the underclass people who are still here, who have not left the island, are going to be stuck with it. I mean, the municipalities here were already wiped out. They already were near bankrupt or bankrupt, and they're going to just be absolutely devastated. That's kind of what I'm looking at for this documentary. I'm working with a really great filmmaker, Den Tolmore, who's an Academy Award nominee for some of his work in the past. We're looking at, you know, the aftermath of the storm and how the people of Puerto Rico are still getting ripped off. To me, it's amazing. And the one thing that I expect, and you can expect too, in September, when people don't, haven't sued and their insurance companies breathe a sigh of relief because they're able to walk away from major losses, And FEMA tells people that you didn't go get your money, so we're not going to pay. The taxpayers are not going to, you know, write you a blank check because you were too shy to sue. Guess who's going to get the blame for it? It's going to be Donald Trump. And of course, it won't be the president's fault. It's just according to law, the FEMA can't, you know, write a check for the money you were supposed to get from your insurance company. I know that sounds like bureaucraties, but at the end of all of this, these people who were wiped out by a major hurricane, Hurricane Maria, are going to suffer for a long, long time. To me, it's amazing, I'm really proud to be working with Den Tolmore on a film down here. I'll be telling you more about it in the future. I'll be right back after these messages here on StillStandingPodcast.com. Still standing.
Please remain standing. We'll be right back.
Hello, it's Michael Caputo again for Still Standing. Thanks a lot for sticking around. We've all heard a lot about this new Gillette ad, you know, the Me Too ad. Is this the best a man can get? I'm down here in Puerto Rico. I just caught it on the internet. I haven't seen it on television yet. Not much time to watch TV down here. But I am, you know, I can tell you, bottom line, as a consumer, when a company that I buy products from does or says has an impact on me, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, when Nike hired Colin Kaepernick, I had to decide whether or not I was going to continue to buy Nike stuff. Now, let's just be, you know, clear. I'm not an athlete. I'm not trying to decide between Nike and Adidas on a regular basis. But while I probably won't be out there buying Nike products again, I'm not going to burn my shoes or take my favorite rain jacket and stop wearing it. I think that while I thought it was a bad marketing decision, it turns out I was wrong. Nike actually succeeded with this marketing strategy, and the furor has died down. I don't know if the people that were mad about it went out and bought Nike products anymore. I think a lot of people, when they make a decision to stop buying something because the company has offended them or made a mistake, they don't usually go back. There's too many choices, especially in America. We have so many products we can buy. But this Gillette razor commercial, it seems to me that they're telling me, a man, that I'm a horrible, horrible person. And I don't know about you, but I don't feel like I'm a horrible person at all. They talk about toxic masculinity, sexual harassment. It's a 2-minute commercial. They couldn't even get their insulting done in under 60 seconds. It got a lot of mixed response. I think they got, applause from the social justice crowd, the media, the people who condemn men anyway. But they got a lot of blowback from what I can see on social media and on some of the partisan media coming from, kind of the pro-men side. You know, it makes me think, since I'm in marketing and public relations, I help on the advertising side for my clients. I don't do advertising, but I certainly advise on messaging and whether or not my clients should move this way or that with their advertising, targeting, things like that. I can't imagine who would advise them that the primary consumer of their product should be a target of criticism in their advertising. I mean, I understand that people want to have what they call an important conversation. I understand that they want to take a realistic look at what's happening today, as they said in the Wall Street Journal, the CEO, somebody from Procter & Gamble who owns Gillette, said we want to have a realistic look at what's happening today and aim to inspire change by acknowledging that the old saying, boys will be boys, is not an excuse. Well, you know what? Nobody's trying to make excuses. I don't even have a son. I have 3 girls, all of them under, 16, 4, and 6 years old. And I advise them on, you know, how to deal with boys all the time. I know that sometimes a boy will be a bully, but a girl will be a bully too. I can tell you that my 16-year-old has experienced bullying, and I'm sure that my 4- and 6-year-old will experience bullying. And typically, young girls are not bullied by boys. Now, they're harassed by boys, but there will always be an asshole in the crowd. I get that. But Gillette wants all of us to believe that, you know, the men of the world and men of America are somehow, you know, ticking time bombs of sexual harassment and toxic masculinity. Toxic masculinity. I can't help but think about how toxic masculinity, you know, freed Europe from the Nazis. How toxic masculinity wins Super Bowls and World Series. What they consider to be toxic. Obviously, masculinity is in and of itself not a crime. And they're trying to make us choose between, you know, Audie Murphy and John Wayne and Pajama Boy. Remember that guy from that ad? Pajama Boy. I'm telling you, I don't find any of this to be a valid conversation for me to have with the manufacturer of my razor. Not interested. I feel like they're targeting me for criticism. And, you know, look, as a Republican and a supporter of Donald Trump, I get criticized all day long, all the way down the line to, you know, death threats. After I appear on one of the cable networks, you know, I'm always being targeted. I don't need it from a consumer product. I don't need it from my coffee. I don't need it from my sneakers. I don't need it from my razor. I'm sorry. Whoever is advising Procter & Gamble, and by the way, I've worked with Procter & Gamble in the past. I really enjoyed the company. I tried early on in my career to get a job there. I think they're great. And I think they're probably one of the best, most important marketing and advertising companies in the world, obviously. I've worked with them in Russia, trying to define some of their personal care products for people in Russia who weren't using things like deodorant and such. And they're brilliant people. And they typically have some of the smartest advertising and marketing people in the world. But who advised them that this was a smart move to accuse their consumer of being toxic? You know, it's a growing problem in today's society. I get that, you know. I don't think it's a problem that's growing any faster than any other, right? Men aren't too masculine. I'm sorry. I don't agree with it. And I guess I shouldn't even apologize, but I don't, you know, I think in today's world, we're seeing more and more of these pajama boy types, more and more of these men who aren't masculine enough, you know. And I think if a man can embrace their masculinity properly without pouring it all over others and without targeting women or other men, that's just good behavior. And from my perspective, it's not any worse than it used to be. It's just that people are hypersensitive to it, especially the hand-wringers that are out there in the kind of social justice movement. And that's what this is all about. That's what bothers me the most about this. It's really unfair to try and, with a 2-minute commercial, kind of pour, you know, just lump all of us into this ball of criticism, all men. I don't have friends who are toxic, masculine assholes. I just don't. My friends are all gentlemen. My friends have sons and daughters, and they teach them, their sons and their daughters, to behave well and become you know, positive role models and strong young men and young women. And, you know, I hate when people say, well, I'm a father of daughters. I got a lot of criticism for saying that once on CNN while we were discussing the Kavanaugh hearings. But I am a father of daughters. And during the Kavanaugh hearings, I called my teenager up and I said, listen, Do you feel like you can call me or come to me, or if some young man does something wrong to you? And she actually told me no, she didn't feel like she could call me, that she felt that I would blame her for being in that situation because I don't, you know, give her enough credit for being a mature young woman, and that she may have just made a mistake, or maybe she was set up and she thinks that I'll immediately blame her. And I told her, I said, look, if you ever find yourself in one of these situations, I promise you I will be on your side. If you want to make a complaint to the police or something terrible happens like that, you're going to have to prove it. But you don't have to prove it to me because you're my daughter. I'm going to believe you. It doesn't matter. And if it's a criminal situation, we'll deal with that together. But you call me, I'll come get you. And God forbid I get anywhere near that young boy who did something wrong to you, because I will take him out. You know, the old story, you know, when my daughter comes home, or when a young man comes to my house to pick her up, she's 16, he's going to have to get through me. You know, I want him to understand that this toxic masculine dad will stomp on his toes if he does anything wrong to my daughter. I'm tired of all this gender shaming. I'm tired of being called, you know, all the names in the book by, you know, radical feminists and the social justice warriors who are out there trying to reshape America. They're not going to reshape me. They're not going to reshape my friends. They're not going to reshape my daughters. I'm going to be making sure that my daughters are raised up in a way where they demand that young men treat them with respect, with equal respect, and that in the workplace they are paid the same and they are treated the same as their male counterparts. And they will demand that because I'm teaching them to do that. But my God, when my razor starts lecturing me, that's when I toss it in the garbage and move on from Gillette to Schick. Because here's the important thing that people in America need to understand. Gillette has been gouging men for years. We overpay for our razors at a rate, at an amount that is unconscionable. Long time ago, I switched to the old replaceable razor where you twist the handle and you use those single blade razors. And I use a brush with soap, the old traditional way, because a long time ago, I realized that these razor companies were gouging the living hell out of me. Now, I still carry a disposable razor on the road, and it's a Gillette. But I'm tossing it out when I get home this time, and I'm switching brands because I don't want to be lectured to by some company whose marketing specialist got a degree in women's studies and is convinced that men are their enemy. I'm not your enemy, Procter & Gamble. I'm not your enemy, Gillette. But I'm a former customer, and you better believe it. I'm Michael Caputo. We'll be right back with more of Still Standing. That's my podcast, stillstandingpodcast.com. Still standing. Hi, it's Michael Caputo again for Still Standing. Thanks for sticking around. I've still got a voice, even though it sounds like it's coming out of my nose. This cold is rocking me. I can't wait to get home and crawl into bed. It's not happening until Friday since I'm still down here in Puerto Rico. But, you know, I saw something that appeared in the Wall Street Journal on January 14th. A very good friend of mine named Constantine Dobrynin wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And you may have heard I know a few things about Russia, and that's a cue for anyone from the Mueller investigation to hit record. But Constantine's article is a really big deal, and he's a really good guy, and I hope you read it. It's called Russia's Future is Wrapped in an Enigma. It's about how musicians in Russia have helped push a kind of anti-establishment moment that could loosen Putin's grip on culture. And I want to tell you this story. If you can't get into the Wall Street Journal, you know it's a subscription-based service over there. And sometimes they don't let you look at it. Sometimes they do. I think Kostya's article may actually be available for free. But in case it's not, I want to tell you about it, because even though here in the United States, we're all concerned about Russia's, meddling in our elections, and no matter, what you believe, it's a fact that Russia was out there messing around on Facebook and Twitter and such. They didn't spend enough money to turn many votes, if they turned any votes at all. But they were certainly playing on social media to try to have an impact on our elections. I don't think it was the first time they've done that, and certainly isn't the last. And we do the same thing to them. I don't think there's any moral equivalency here. I think Putin had terrible designs. Our country goes out and tries to, get behind democratic movements because we think it's the best thing for society. Putin, what he wants to do, of course, is just mess us up. But what Kostya Dobrynin was talking about in his article is that in November of this past year, a rapper in Russia named Husky, his real name is, Dmitry Kuznetsov, but everybody calls him Husky. He kind of looks a bit like, if you were to compare him to an American rapper, he's white. Almost all of Russia is white. But he's a pretty talented young man in his 20s. And a former journalist, actually, and has a pretty, as you would expect, rappers, lyrics to be a bit vile, a bit anti-establishment, kind of idolizes drugs a little bit. Sound familiar? Sound like rap in the United States? Pretty much is. But, the authorities there were putting a lot of pressure on the rap culture as being something they don't, cotton to. And in fact, had told Husky that he couldn't have his concerts. They actually banned him. The police did. Well, he got upset that one of his concerts was banned and went outside of his concert that was canceled and stood on top of a car and said about 30 seconds of one of his rap lyrics. The police came, snatched him up, tossed him in jail, and that set off a very interesting series of events in Russia. In fact, Husky was released 12 days later. They had organized a huge concert in his honor with all kinds of other rappers. This guy named Oxymiron. He's kind of the Russian Eminem, actually. And other musicians, they were going to have the most important cultural event of the year, this big concert. This is right around the time you and I were having Thanksgiving. The Russians felt so much pressure from this kind of move that they released Husky even before the concert happened. And not only that, what's really interesting is that Putin himself came out and he said that rap should be left without state control. And these artists should be free to creatively perform, which was really quite remarkable. And the reason it's remarkable, and what Konstantin Dobrynin says in his article this week in the Wall Street Journal, is that it reminds us all, those of us who have an idea of history, of the 80s, when rock and roll was, it used to be the rockers were being chased by the police, having underground concerts. And I know a lot of Russian rockers. A reminder, I lived there throughout almost all the 1990s. And I was involved in the music business as the founder of Rock the Vote Russia. And I know a lot of these guys, very interesting cats, all of them. But in the 80s, before I showed up, they were getting arrested. They were getting roughed up in the streets by the police until Perestroika, when, Gorbachev actually got a lot of pressure to stop treating these people badly and to just let rock and roll develop. And he did. And in fact, in a lot of ways, rock and roll was one of the inspirations of the freedom that ended up taking over Russia and, the end of the Soviet Union. Not in a small way. Rock and roll and the artists and the top artists of the rock and roll bands in Russia were inspirational to a lot of people that if we can have this small bit of freedom, we can have more freedom. And here in 2018, the same thing happened kind of in parallel with this young rapper And in a small way, not in a small way, a pretty significant way, Vladimir Putin blinked. And it's pretty surprising. He actually said that these young men and women who are involved in rap should be free of political pressure, which is almost precisely what Gorbachev said, which presaged the fall of the wall. Now, that's not the only thing that happened in 2018, according to DeBrennan's article on things that we probably, if you're paying attention, you saw. Some things like just at the new year, the Ukrainian church was declared independent of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is a really big deal, even more big than the general idea of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church being separate and separated from the Russian Orthodox Church, is that the Putin and his state authorities didn't even try and fight it. I mean, that's, again, remarkable, because the Russian Orthodox Church is at the very core of Vladimir Putin's ideology, at the very core of Vladimir Putin's government. If you understand what's happening in Russia, what's happened since Putin took over, there's been a rise of this Orthodox mindset that Putin has really sponsored. And, you know, anyone who wants to be in good standing with Vladimir Putin better be going to church. And they just let the Ukrainian Orthodox Church separate. That's a big deal. It just happened. And just like the Husky thing, it presages something very interesting. You know, other things happened. I mean, I think you, all of us, if you're paying attention, saw, you know, several different failures of the Russian intelligence services. You know, scandals, in fact, like the poisoning of former intelligence agent Sergei Skripal. They really messed that up. And then they tried to put a cyber attack on the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the European organization. They were investigating the Skripal case, and that cyber attack failed, and they got busted for it. They also, people in Russia figured out that the Kremlin was involved in a failed coup in Montenegro, and also they were messing things up in Greece and Macedonia. And when the Russian intelligence services suffer scandals like this, it kind of, you know, just like rock and roll in the 80s, it kind of presages, it's a preliminary event to pretty radical change. If you look back in the 80s, there were similar scandals in the Siloviki, in the intelligence services, the military services. And Russians are looking at these things that happened, the Skripal case, et cetera, all these bungled intelligence operations, and saying, you know, this is a weak point in Putin's intelligence services. That's a big deal. Other things happened as well, things that you and I typically wouldn't know. A lot of opposition candidates were elected, underdog opposition candidates in regional governorships. I know you probably don't care too much about that, but that's a big deal when they're running against a Kremlin-sanctioned incumbent and they beat them. Even though you can't really run for election in Russia unless you kind of have a wink and a nod from the Putinists, the Kremlin incumbents were defeated, and an underdog opposition candidate was elected in a governor race, there are 89 states in Russia, and four of them were elected out of the opposition arena. Pretty amazing stuff, really. And also, another thing that happened that the Korchy talks about, he's an attorney. He used to be the head of the Russian Bar Association. And he was, the equivalent of a United States senator in Russia, and got out because it's just a little bit too dangerous to be in the opposition. But 50%, there is a 50% rate of acquittals in criminal trials last year in Moscow. 50%. And that's pretty remarkable, because it shows that Russians have begun to challenge the country's law enforcement system. I mean, publicly, it's a big deal. I mean, it used to be something like 95, 98% conviction rates, 50% acquittals. Things are changing in Russia. And this article by my friend Konstantin Dobrynin is something you should pay attention to. Now, there's still a lot of problems, of course. I mean, the Russia-Ukraine conflict is a big deal. And of course, he actually talks about what needs to happen to try to resolve that. But history proves, if you pay any attention at all to Russian history, the 2018 is a pretty remarkable year, and that something might change in Russia in 2019. Not necessarily because Putin is weak, but he's weakened. And it all started with a rapper. You believe that? Rap is really changing Russia, just like rock and roll in the 80s. Check him out. Husky is his name. Listen to his rap. It's in Russian, but it's good. It's Michael Caputo. I'll be right back after these messages for stillstandingpodcast.com. I'm on the road in Puerto Rico, so I don't have my list of executive producers to thank. I want to make sure everyone who supports us on Patreon.com, who is a subscriber to Still Standing. I want to thank you very much for your support. If you like Still Standing, please subscribe on iTunes or whatever platform you listen to. And if you really want to give us a hand, you can help us out a little bit, a couple of bucks a month on Patreon.com. It always helps. But as I close this week's episode, I wanted to give you a bit of an inside perspective on something. You know, I talk to reporters all week long. You know, I appear on cable television. I'm quoted in the media a lot. But a lot of the discussions I have with reporters never end up in the media. I spend a lot of time on the phone and on the internet talking to reporters as they try to figure out what's next and what's happening in the Trump administration, in the Mueller investigation in particular, in the congressional investigations, into the bogus idea that Russia and the Trump campaign colluded together in order to defeat the hag Hillary Clinton. And one thing I've noticed in the last couple, last week, is that more and more journalists, producers, TV hosts are starting to talk about the end of the Mueller investigation. Now, I don't see it. My lawyers don't see it, as you probably know. I'm caught up in the jackpot of this bogus Russia investigation. I've had to testify before the House, the Senate, and the Mueller team. It costs a lot of money. And I think there's about 40 or 50 of us who are paying five to six figures in legal fees. And a lot of the people who are subscribers to my podcast contributed to a GoFundMe, which was so helpful in making sure that my attorneys got paid. I want to thank you again for that. But I've actually been contacted by two different networks, TV news networks, who've asked me to participate in shows that are going to mark the end of the Mueller investigation. And it seems to me that they believe it's happening soon because they're trying to get me on air next week and the week after. Honestly, they believe that the Mueller investigation is done. And this is happening just after they extended the grand jury associated with the Mueller investigation for 6 months. And also just the day, yesterday, day before, we saw some news on abcnews.com. Great story there. A little tough on my friend Roger Stone, but revealed that there are three different associates around this guy, Jerome Corsi, an interesting cat, were subpoenaed, two in December and one actually testifying before the grand jury on Friday. The one testifying before the grand jury on Friday is his stepson, who apparently, wiped his computer so that his wife could use Jerome Corsi's computer in her new business. Now, that's one more grand jury appearance by one person associated with Jerry Corsi, who appears to be a pretty marginal witness, just some kind of computer guy. Maybe these producers are right. Maybe this thing is coming to an end. We've seen some reporting on this. There's a lot more talk about the report that is going to come out from the Mueller investigation, whether it will be shown to the public or whether it will be private, whether the president is going to respond and in what way. I mean, we saw interviews with Giuliani talking about how he wants to have an opportunity to respond. So he wants to have a look at the report before it's released. And really, we don't even know if it's going to be released. That is the choice of the new attorney general, William Barr, who looks to be on his way to being confirmed. So the tea leaves are showing me that Robert Mueller may be wrapping up. And that's great. I'm tired of it. It never should have happened to begin with. And now we see more and more stories about how this special counsel appointment seems to be part of a pretty broad, I don't know. I mean, it appears that the Obama administration weaponized the intelligence community and the Department of Justice to spy upon the Republican candidate for president of the United States. That's pretty clear. Not just the DOJ, not just the FBI, but the CIA, the NSA, and even foreign intelligence services from Australia and the UK appear to be wrapped up in this attempt to spy upon Donald Trump and Donald Trump's team. And I don't think that Mueller was ever going to get to the bottom of that. I mean, for example, General Flynn had a conversation with the Russian ambassador, completely legal, in his role in the transition as the incoming national security advisor, had a conversation with the Russian ambassador that was apparently caught on, in the intelligence community tracks the phone calls and other communications of key foreign ambassadors, certainly the Russian ambassador. I'm sure they do the same thing to the Chinese and the Turkish ambassadors, right? But they were catching this conversation. That conversation, the transcript of it was leaked by somebody in the Obama intelligence leadership to the Washington Post. No doubt about it. It's very clear. It was written up in the Washington Post, and that's how they pretty much got rid of General Flynn. And even though if the Mueller investigation was the least bit even-handed, the least bit interested in national security, they would find out who that leaker was. There is no indication today that the Mueller team is looking into that criminal, felonious leak. Now, there's only so many people who had access to that information. It's a small room full of people, and you could have narrowed that down. It doesn't appear like they even tried. So even the one of the seminal crimes that took place in order to initiate this all-out war against the Trump administration, this leak of intelligence information by the Obama White House, probably, never even investigated. Seminal crime of this whole entire thing, never even investigated by the Mueller team. You know, I spent my time sitting in front of the Mueller team. I have a deep and abiding respect for the FBI. I always have. The two FBI agents in the room when I was being interviewed were very respectful, quiet, and seemed to be diligently moving through their duties. The prosecutor, it's a different story entirely. Aaron Zelinsky is the prosecutor who sat before me. But the FBI agents in the Mueller investigation, the FBI agents that I've known through my career, through my life, I believe are truly devoted to law enforcement and protecting all of us from our enemies, foreign and domestic. But we truly had a problem at the FBI, in the main office of the FBI, in the political office of the FBI. Clearly, they were trying to spy upon the Republican candidate for president. The FISA abuse that was wrapped around it, all of that should have been looked into, I believe. And maybe it is. Maybe it still is. Maybe the end of the Mueller investigation will not signal the end to the investigation that needs to take place into the spying operation that was put together by the Obama White House to spy upon Donald Trump. maybe that's not over. In fact, it looks like we're probably seeing more of it. But anybody who tells you that there is some kind of secret investigation and thousands of sealed secret indictments and they're refurbishing Guantanamo to round up the Clintons and everybody else and put them in jail for their crimes against America, don't believe them. That's not how America works. And it's unfortunate that we don't really have an even-handed justice system. I've said it before and I'll say it again. This is not the Department of Justice. This is the Department of Just Us. They're there to protect primarily those in the swamp who protect the establishment. They protect the people, the permanent political class of the United States. And that includes the Clintons. That includes the Obamas. That includes the Department of Justice itself. If anybody tells you that the Inspector General of the Department of Justice is there in order to diligently, investigate the Department of Justice itself, yeah, well, he'll scratch at the surface, of course. But he'll never truly indict the fiber and the being of the Department of Justice. It will never happen. And really, the problems we have now in Maine justice and the political appointees of the FBI, maybe we're cleaning it up, but this is a fundamental cultural problem at the United States Department of Justice. We have cultural problems in our intelligence services across the board. You don't have to look any further than CNN, where they're all employed today, Brennan and the rest of them. It's interesting. I think, actually, a lot of these guys who committed these crimes in spying upon the Republican candidate for president, they were placed at television and other networks in order to get First Amendment protections when and if it ever becomes clear that they're being investigated. Who knows? But I can tell you this. It looks like the tea leaves are pointing to the fact that Mueller is really wrapping up. That would be great for my family. Of course, we all have to deal with the House Democrats who appear at the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence to be reopening the bogus Russia investigation because they love the cameras. That's why they're doing it. Make no mistake, they're addicted to the media coverage. And some of them are running for president. This is all politics. It always has been. But from here forward, it is pure partisan politics. Mueller and his team of investigators seem to be wrapping up. Let's hope that's true. Michael Caputo for still standing. I really appreciate you tuning in. Again, check us out on patreon.com. Subscribe if you will. Listen to some of the videos. I put out a video a week as well. Blog a little bit at stillstandingpodcast.com. Really appreciate you listening in. I appreciate it very, very much. You can catch me, of course, on WBEN as well. That's the Buffalo Talk radio station where I sit in now and then. You have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Have a great day.